percent. 77 degrees Racine, 76 this morning in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's interview is from the Morning Show archives. We spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about The Strenuous Life. That is the title of a book that was written by Theodore Roosevelt, and more to the point, also the title of a brand new book written by my morning show guest, Ryan Swanson. And in this book, we examine the way in which athletics took on a whole new meaning in America during the first decade of the 20th century, which coincided, of course, with the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt. And for Theodore Roosevelt himself, sports played a very important role. It was key to who he was, for the kind of man that he grew up to become, and what he envisioned as the fullest and richest kind of life that that people, and especially men at that time, were meant to enjoy in this new nation, this new powerful nation of the United States. And in this fascinating book, Ryan Swanson explores this concept in a number of different ways, in very probing fashion. And he brings a rich array of life experience to the task. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of New Mexico's Honors College. He has written a number of different books, including When Baseball Went White, Reconstruction, Reconciliation, and Dreams of a National Pastime. And this book, The Strenuous Life, is published by Diversion Books. And Ryan Swanson, we welcome you to the morning show.
Yeah, thanks for that generous introduction. I'm glad to be here.
I'm really excited to be speaking with you about your really fascinating book. I'm just curious, do you come to your interest in the intersection of American life and athletics as someone out on the field or up in the stands or purely as a historian? I mean, how do you tie into this particular interest, which, among other things, has fueled the writing of this book?
Yeah, that's a really fair question. A good place to start. I come at this project from a couple of different ways. Certainly, there's the academic side of things. I'm a historian. I'm a college teacher, professor. So I was very interested and very interested in the question of kind of how we got this way as a nation in terms of sports. How did we get to the point where many of us put our kids in youth sports and we gather for Super Bowl parties and we expect our universities to have intercollegiate teams? So that was one of the core questions kind of at the root of this that took me back to Roosevelt. How did we get like this? Because we are different than other nations when it comes to sports. So absolutely there's this kind of intellectual question here. But as you hinted at in your question, there's a personal side of this too. A long time ago, I was a kind of middling high school and college athlete. It was important to me in terms of kind of my personal development and the way I thought of myself. I still try to get out there and do a bit of jogging and stay in shape, you know, so I do that as well. But I would say part of what crystallized this project for me was watching my kids play sports. I've got three kids between ages 9 and 14, and each of them have done the youth sports thing, and indeed still are. And so sometimes, you know, I'd be sitting there at the sideline of this umpteenth soccer game it felt like I was attending for the week, and, you know, thinking, what are we doing here? You know, we're at another game. And, you know, actually there was one moment where it all kind of hit home for me. My oldest son was playing in a baseball game, a little league game here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And for those of you who haven't had a chance to come to Albuquerque in the spring, I say lucky for you. It's really windy, you know, really windy here in the spring. And our temperatures go from the 30s up to the 70s. And so he's at this game. And it's in the high 30s. It's really cold. This wind is roaring in from the outfield. Dust is blowing everywhere. I wear contact lenses. I could hardly open my eyes, it felt like. And I'm watching my son out in the outfield doing jumping jacks. He's in left field, so, you know, there's no chance a ball is actually going to go to him. And he's doing jumping jacks, trying to stay warm. And the umpire notices this. He steps out from behind the plate and yells out to my son in left field, "Hey, stop doing that. No jumping jacks." You know, and I could tell immediately my son was embarrassed, and he kind of, you know, backed off and kind of slunk away. And it was kind of like, this is crazy. You know, there's a craziness to this system that's here, but we often take it for granted. So all of that's kind of a long way to get back to your question. You know, what brought me to this? It's both an intellectual but also a personal project. And Roosevelt was really a fun way to investigate all of that.
Absolutely. And one thing I want to say is that President Roosevelt apparently was quite the letter writer, as were many people of that generation, and apparently many of his letters have been preserved because they form such a rich core to what you present in this book. Just tell us a little bit about, in a sense, the written legacy that Theodore Roosevelt left behind him, and what the experience was like for you to delve deeply into this facet of his life and this, in a sense, written legacy of who he was and what he most highly valued.
One of the real, I think, benefits and challenges of studying Roosevelt is just what you're talking about. He produced so much written content during his life that it's both inspiring and daunting to go through it. In terms of numbers, he wrote about 150,000 letters during his lifetime. Depending on how you count the edited collections and whatnot, he wrote somewhere around 38 books. And so he writes about everything, you know, with that kind of volume, and including sports. He writes a lot about sports, both in terms of letters to his children, letters to other people, official documents as president, and then he writes about it in his books. And so my process in this project was trying to sift through all of this written record and find what was useful. And I'll admit, there were huge chunks of time when I was at the Library of Congress or at Harvard. You know, Harvard has a major collection of Roosevelt's, where I would just get sidetracked because he's a beautiful writer, and he writes these amazing letters to his children. And he oftentimes, you know, puts in his letters, he'll make these little pictures of, you know, him on a horse or him playing tennis. And so it's just a really amazing kind of intimate look you get at his life through these letters. And I guess I think of, you know, the way we communicate now, we're kind of even leaving email behind, so somebody's going to have to look at, I guess, the texts or tweets of, you know, our generation and try to figure it out. But yeah, it's just a rich trove of information, his written legacy.
I am guessing that as you undertook the writing of this book, you already were well aware that something happened in this first decade of the 20th century, and maybe you even knew exactly what happened, but maybe didn't know how it happened or why it happened. I mean, in a sense, what was the experience of discovery that you had in researching this book? What kinds of questions did you have going into it?
I think I knew some things, and now that the project is done, I realize I didn't know a lot of things, too, or I was incorrect in my assumptions about a lot of things. But as somebody who's written about sports, in the United States on a number, you know, I've done a bunch of kind of articles and chapters and some books. I certainly was aware of the fact that the beginning of the 20th century was a crucial time. You know, one project, for example, I had worked on, I'd written about the rise of college conferences. You know, how do we have these associations, the Big Ten in your part, you know, neck of the woods, the Mountain West here, the Pac-10. How do universities make those associations? Well, I saw, you know, it was back at the early 20th century that happened. So, yeah, I knew that there were some important connections being made there. And certainly these bits and pieces of Roosevelt the athlete has been, these stories have been told in, you know, like the big biographies of Roosevelt or in, you know, discussions of sports. And so I knew something was going on there. But again, my goal was to kind of try to figure out, you know, when did this structure that we take for granted today in terms of our sports and athletics, when did it really take off? So I knew that I wanted to look back towards that time period. As a historian, you know, I tend to think, I don't know, anything within the past 50 years is still kind of playing out. You know, we can't understand it yet. So it was an enjoyable process of learning about what went on there. And I'll admit that, you know, there were perhaps times when I thought Roosevelt was going to be the answer, or kind of explain it all. And I was corrected in that. You know, Roosevelt is a key figure. He talks about sports a lot. He's an athlete himself. He tries to control everything. But one of the beauties of this story as well is the fact that, try as he might to control this huge movement, a lot of things get away from him. So it's both Roosevelt explaining this revolution in sports, but also Roosevelt not being able to control it in any way. So it was a fun kind of discovery process.
And it's interesting to me how, at a glance, this might seem like a relatively modest undertaking. I mean, that you're not writing a biography of Theodore Roosevelt, or you're not writing about every aspect of this turn of the century time in our country. All you're writing about is the emergence of sports in a new way, or as you say, how the landscape of American sports changed dramatically in mm-hmm. this first decade. And yet, that's not a modest undertaking at all. I mean, it's actually, at least I was surprised at how kind of complex the picture is. I suspect maybe you were surprised by that as well.
I certainly was, you know, and I think it's, you know, it's funny being someone who has the luxury of studying these kinds of things. You know, I certainly am the first one to tell people, you know, I'm not curing cancer here. You know, I'm writing about sports in America and what's going on. And so, yeah, and unlike some of these major biographies of Roosevelt, no, I'm not covering, you know, the lead up to the 1902 congressional elections and how Roosevelt's campaigning. I'm covering really this role of sports. But with that said, to try to understand this revolution in sports draws you in all sorts of areas that Roosevelt has his fingertips just kind of in. So you have to learn about the history of college football, you know, what's going on in tennis, how are universities evolving, what's this NCAA, you know, I had to learn about the Olympic movement. So yeah, it's a targeted TR study that then just kind of goes in all sorts of interesting ways because of the sports angle. So I think, you know, I always tell my students, make sure you pick a project that is suitable in its scope. It can't be so huge, it can't be so small. And I think this, you know, this worked on that level.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Ryan Swanson about his newest book, which is called The Strenuous Life, Theodore Roosevelt and the Making of the American Athlete. One thing that I think your book is very helpful for is to, in a sense, correct some simplistic assumptions that we tend to make about Theodore Roosevelt himself and sort of his own athletic odyssey, his development from a sickly, puny, asthmatic youngster into the strapping adult that he eventually became. It's actually a more complicated question or story than we are sometimes given if all we do is glance at historical headlines. Give our listeners a sense of just how kind of complicated this picture is and this story of Roosevelt and the way in which he, over time, in a sense, physically blossomed.
Yeah, so a lot of people know, as you mentioned, that Roosevelt has terrible asthma as a child. And to kind of fast forward to the other headline, a lot of people have then heard that he cures himself of this and he gets stronger through exercise. And if you only know those little two tidbits, it is indeed a bit misleading. But here's kind of the, you know, here's kind of the story arc, if you will. Roosevelt does, he has terrible asthma as a child. I mean, this is not tightness of breath or anything like that. This is a crisis on a daily basis. He cannot breathe. His family tries everything to deal with this. Unfortunately, the albuterol inhaler, which, you know, is really important today, that's not, you know, the beginnings of that aren't until the 1950s. So, you know, he can't go to school. He is not on any kind of athletic team. He's not out there playing on the playground. So his early years, you know, about age three until his teens, no, he can't do anything athletically. His parents have him smoke cigars, bloodletting, drink a lot of coffee, all these things to try to deal with asthma. So it's really terrible. So what happens then is when Roosevelt hits his early teen years, his father calls him in for a heart-to-heart. And to paraphrase, what his father says is, you're smart, you read a lot, but if you don't make your body, you're not going to make it. And you've got your mind, but you have to make your body, he says. And so Roosevelt, this is a key moment for Roosevelt, and he'll remember this and retell this story often. And so he, you know, what Roosevelt's response to his father there as a teenager is, I'll do it. I'm going to make my body. Now think about this for a second, right? It seems unfair to me as a father to ask your kid to basically cure his own asthma, right? That doesn't seem very nice, but Roosevelt does. He starts this exercise program. He starts training at a gym, wrestling, boxing, and something miraculous happens. His asthma basically goes away, or it gets much, it lessens in its intensity. Now, what we know today is that it's fairly common for asthmatic children to kind of age out of the worst of it as they hit their teen years. But for Roosevelt, he sees there being this absolute connection. I was sickly and weak, and then I exercised, and I'm now strong and robust. And of course, it's not that simple. But that he really believes in that causation, so he will tell this story. And then, you know, he goes on to Harvard, and he goes to the boxing gym every day. And then when he's governor and president, you know, he'll play tennis and he'll box and he'll wrestle and he'll go on these long point-to-point hikes. And so the press really picks up on this idea of him. He was weak back then. He devoted himself to the strenuous life, and now he is strong. And there are parts of truth to that. But again, you know, there's some nuance, as you suggest.
Yeah, I find that so interesting. I mean, first, the whole matter of, you know, chances are he just kind of grew out of his asthma, as is so often the case. And the other part of the narration that is intriguing is that we tend to think of him as a marvelous athlete, a marvelously gifted, skilled athlete. And one of the things your book does is sort of shakes us loose of that picture. And it's not even so much that Roosevelt himself sort of grandiosely proclaimed himself to be a fine athlete. In fact, it sounds like in many of his letters, he's fairly honest about his own limitations in terms of both talent and skills. But he brought other factors to the table that could sometimes make him kind of a formidable opponent. Just talk for a moment about Roosevelt's own athleticism and his strengths and his many weaknesses.
Roosevelt, in his letters, will say over and over again that what he's really striving for athletically is to be average. He doesn't want anybody to make fun of him as a young man. And then as he's older and thinking about what sports to do, he puts himself out there as an example. He'll say, I was never a champion, but athletics and sports still did something for me. So what Roosevelt brings to the court or to the field when he's out there is a lot of effort. You know, think of that guy maybe you've had on your beer league softball team or, you know, intramural basketball, who just plays way too hard, right? You know, I mean, everybody's out there trying to exercise and have fun, but there's this guy who's too crazy about it. That's kind of Roosevelt. He brings a lot of intensity, a lot of energy, a lot of enthusiasm to the boxing ring or to wrestling or to these things, and that's really his attribute. And I think that's even more intriguing as he's in his 40s and 50s because he doesn't age out of that. He seems to love to go full bore just as much in his 40s and 50s. And I think that's actually when you see him really shine, if you will, as an athlete, because while his peers seem to be getting deeply into middle age and not moving as much. Roosevelt really fights that. And so on the tennis court, he's all over the place trying his best, even if he's not all that great of a technician. And again, he goes on these point-to-point hikes where he really transcends kind of normal athletic behavior. You know, he doesn't go out for a simple jog or a simple walk. Nope, he's going to go on a point-to-point hike between here and there and cut through the river and over the quarry and do these kinds of crazy things. So I think it's that willingness to be different and to go all in that's his biggest strengths as an athlete. And then just maybe one other thing. He is a decent boxer. So he picks up some skills in the ring. By the time he's in his 20s, he's much more muscular than he was as a young man. So he's a decent boxer, a decent wrestler, but he's not this great athlete as sometimes he's inaccurately portrayed to be.
Right. And I think maybe one way in which we leap to that conclusion, too, is that there's a fairly famous photograph of Theodore Roosevelt from 1877, and I don't remember now what age that would make him. I think maybe in his 20s, but
right there at about 20, yeah.
Yeah, and he's sitting there, arms folded. He is shirtless, and we can kind of tell that this is a guy who is pretty darn well built. I mean, there is plenty of muscle on the frame of young Theodore Roosevelt, and of course, we can see a picture like that and leap to the conclusion that this is a very skilled athlete, mm-hmm. and that's not really the whole story.
Not really, no. I mean, that picture that you're speaking of is from Harvard, and he's kind of at his peak physical condition, right? If all of us could be remembered for as good as we looked at our best stage, you know, I'd love it too. But you know, after college, he struggles with his weight. You know, like so many Americans throughout his entire adult life, he's always balancing his love of exercise with the fact that he continues to eat like a teenager all through his life as well. So, but he's got that one picture that many of us hold in our minds.
Right. Could you just say a word about, because I think it says a lot about how important all of this was to Theodore Roosevelt, the journal which he painstakingly maintained during his later teenage years as he chronicled his progress in terms of athletic and physical development. I think this is so fascinating.
Roosevelt approaches everything in his own way, and a part of his thinking is to, you know, gather data and to record things and to try to figure out details. He loves to use Latin terms, you know, scientific terms for things. So the same as he does that when he's investigating the outside or studying at Harvard, he applies those same tendencies to athletics as he's trying to ramp up from his weak childhood. So he keeps this diary, athletic diary, as he's in his late teen years, and he writes down basically everything he can, anything recordable he'll write down. So if he does, you know, if he has a boxing sparring session with somebody, he'll write down how it went, you know, went three rounds with so-and-so and bested him. I think one of my favorite parts of this journal is the fact that much of the data he collects is done with his younger brother. And so he records painstakingly as older brother, you know, or actually against his cousins as well, you know, competed in this race and won. And so it's kind of, you know, he writes down over and over again how his younger cousins and younger brother can't quite keep up with him. And so, I don't know, to me that just strikes me as typical older brother behavior. So even as he's scientist, he's kind of sticking it to his younger brother. But yeah, it's a whole journal filled with these statistics of how much he lifted and his measurements. You know, he'll measure his chest and his arms. You know, here's how big I'm getting. And then he'll write down, yeah, you know, I beat my younger brother again too. So it speaks, I think, to his curious mind and the way that he applied it to the physical side of things.
Right. And you are so right in that it also gives us such a vivid picture of the human being. I mean, this is not one of those four presidents on Mount Rushmore. This is someone who is flesh and blood, like you and I, with many of the same vulnerabilities, many of the same hopes and dreams. I mean, he is really alive to us in this journal and in these letters.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what makes them such interesting primary sources.
We're speaking with Ryan Swanson about his book, The Strenuous Life, Theodore Roosevelt and the Making of the American Athlete. It's important that we understand that your book is not just about Theodore Roosevelt himself, but about all that was happening in the whole landscape of sports and athletics in this first decade of the 20th century, coinciding with the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt. And I just want to add parenthetically that you make an observation, speaking of his ascension to the presidency after McKinley's assassination, you make an observation that I had never seen anyplace else before. And that is that when William McKinley was assassinated in 1901, it was the third time in 50 years that the U.S. had lost a president to assassination. First Lincoln, then Garfield, then McKinley. And you point out that this would be the third time in some Americans' lives. In other words, you wouldn't have to be all that elderly to have lived through all three of those presidential assassinations. I think that's a fascinating observation, and while it's not directly to the point of your book, I think it maybe does say something about all that our nation had experienced and about kind of the robust vigor with which they wanted to enter the 20th century.
Yeah, I think so. Thank you for that that comment on what's a small part of the book. But I was trying to get at, as it sounds like maybe you've got, the nation's at a tough spot. You know, it's several decades into industrialization and urbanization, so there's change, you know, more technology, more cities. But there's also this belief that the future is uncertain. If you are in your 70s, 60s, you can remember three presidents being killed. There's tumult elsewhere, too, in the world. There are these assassinations going on. So when Roosevelt takes the White House, there's absolutely a desire for a president that projects life and vigor and aggressiveness, because the nation has kind of seen these difficult things happen. And so when Roosevelt comes along and he goes to football games and boxes and does these things, I think there's some overcompensation by the press to pick up on it. You know, look at this guy. Look at America. Look at us. We are, you know, we're going places, and we do have a future, and we're tough enough to make it in this new world. And so that's, you know, I think where Roosevelt comes onto the scene. And while he would always be a powerful personality because of that, you know, the way he comes to the office, I think he's even more powerful. Mm.
The title of your book is The Strenuous Life. And you point out to us that this was a phrase that Roosevelt himself coined in a really important speech that he delivered in Chicago in 1899. So this is ahead of him becoming President Roosevelt. And there is much that is tied up here that sets the stage for what follows in your book. Explain why Roosevelt was speaking on this topic in the first place, and what he said in 1899 that, in a sense, helps us understand who he was and what was ahead for him and the nation.
So Roosevelt comes back from the Spanish-American War as an American hero. He's very high profile. He comes to kind of symbolize that conflict, he and his Rough Riders do. He's, you know, within 8 months elected governor of New York, despite the fact he's living in Washington, D.C., you know, that kind of minor residence issue. And so he's invited to give this speech in 1899, and he gives a speech that is primarily, if you just look at the text, you'd assume it's, you know, it's about military things. It's about imperialism. It's about the United States controlling what it has worked so hard to get in this recent conflict. But what's interesting about it is once he gives the speech and he comes up with this term, the strenuous life, you know, he urges Americans not to live in fear, but to strike forth and go after aggressive things. The term, the strenuous life, takes on a life of its own. And it becomes known, you know, as really one of the key descriptors of Roosevelt himself. I mentioned in the book that if you look at the year 1902, easily more than 10,000 times is Roosevelt referred to using the word strenuous in the newspaper. It's strenuous. He's a strenuous eater, a strenuous exerciser. It talks about his strenuous parenting. They use, you know, strange derivations of the word like strenuosity. and so this comes to be like, you know, summarize what's going on. But more so than any sort of diplomatic connotations, the strenuous life becomes really associated with physical vigor, with athleticism, and with sports. And so for a lot of Americans who are probably noticing that new organizations are cropping up and that college sports are happening, the strenuous life becomes something that they can almost take on for themselves. You know, if you're, let's say, 40 years old in the turn of the century, it's not that you're going to go join a team or something like that, but the idea that, maybe I should lift some weights, or maybe I should head out on a walk, or maybe I should do this because my work isn't the same as it was for my ancestors, really starts to take hold. And one comparison I made of the strenuous life, which I did with some caution, was that in some ways it reminds me of the way that Just Do It for Nike functioned for a while. I don't know if you remember
sure.
that tagline?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it was obviously meant to sell shoes, right? But it also kind of took on a cultural meaning there for a while, where it was, you know, you've got a rainy day in front of you, and you're thinking about if lacing up your shoes or staying inside. You know, just do it. Get out there and push yourself. And I'd say the strenuous life was somewhat similar to these, you know, this turn of the century American public. Live the strenuous life. Just do it. It was kind of the same idea. So that was what I was trying to get at in covering that term, and ultimately that, you know, becomes the title of the book.
Right. And you're touching on something that is of central importance, namely that with the rapid urbanization of America in the late 19th century into the early 20th century, you have many young people experiencing a childhood very different from that of a few decades earlier. You write at one point, there was no time to waste. While country boys were tossing hay bales and digging post holes to develop rugged muscular bodies, the residents of cities were getting weaker by the day. Urban life was depriving children of the physical rites of passage that their ancestors had taken for granted. I'm wondering if you think this was in fact true, or is this more something that seemed to be true? I mean, I guess maybe my question is, were people being more alarmed about this than they needed to be for whatever reason? Or was there a legitimate reason to be concerned in the same way that we're very legitimately concerned today about young people spending too much time in front of computer screens, for instance?
Right. Well, if I can sit on the fence, you know, I'd say it's both. I think there, you know, is that unfair? You know, I'd say there's reason to be concerned. Cities are, you know, at the turn of the century, unhealthy places. There are not a lot of open spaces, not a lot of greenery. Children are not, you know, running around and doing physical farm work, say, the way they had done 50, 60 years before. So, yeah, that's reason for concern. And doctors are seeing, you know, a rise in cases of kind of weakness and feebleness that is causing concern. So there is real reason for concern, but I think you get at another side of it when, yeah, there's a bit of paranoia coming with it, too. Change is disconcerting, and part of this is change, not necessarily good or bad, but simply a change in the way that people are living. So there's a real concern that gets blown out of proportion, and I think perhaps this is inherent in parenting. I think a lot of it is connected to the way parents are looking at their children. You know, this isn't the way I grew up. I didn't live in this kind of urbanized area. I didn't do these kinds of things. And so as they look at their children and worry about what kinds of citizens they're going to grow up to be, sports becomes an avenue to, well, you know, we can't send them out to milk the cows and dig holes, but maybe we put them on a sports team at school and do those kinds of things. And the connection you made in terms of modern life today, I think I see a lot of similarities between the angst of today and the angst of the, you know, the 20th century. We have more technology now, right? We have our smartphones, and our kids are all playing Fortnite instead of going outside or whatever it is. And, yeah, we're concerned about that. And so I think that the way we think about youth sports today, you know, they might stay in their room all day if we let them, but let's stick them on a team where they practice on Tuesday and Thursday. At least they'll do that. So I think it's real concern and also real issues, certainly in Roosevelt's time, and I would argue probably the same today.
Right. I am reminded, by the way, of something else from Theodore Roosevelt's own story that I also had never heard before, back to the days when he was suffering so acutely from asthma. You tell us that the condition terrorized and embarrassed Roosevelt. Part of the shame came from the fact that during the 19th century, asthma was understood as a nervous, neurotic affliction. That just points to the fact that this is still a time when we did not yet have all that accurate an understanding of why people are the way they are physically, for instance, and that if we're operating in a system where those kind of mistaken assumptions get made, it's easy to understand why people might gravitate to solutions like, let's get everybody involved in sports, and maybe these things will just fade away.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Roosevelt has his character called into question as a child because of his asthma, and that's really common at the time. And I think it's, you know, it's kind of heartbreaking to look back and think about children under that kind of oppression, both physically and emotionally. You know, is this? It's not only is this kid weak or can't breathe, but it's is he or she of you know, not much character. And so perhaps, again, to draw just a vague comparison, perhaps, you know, it relates to the way at one time we thought about depression or mental illness as a, you know, get your act together, you know, rub some dirt on it, you know, get over it. Now we know that, no, these are, you know, they're physiological problems going on, but that's asthma during Roosevelt's time. So to suffer from asthma means you are not just weak, but perhaps, you know, bad or not a good person as well.
Right. So for whatever reason, probably for a plethora of reasons, there is suddenly this heightened attention to weaving athletic endeavor directly into the fabric of our life in a way that it had not already been. Let's talk about some of the specific ways in which athletic endeavor really changes. And it's intriguing how in a number of different sports we find things changing quite dramatically. And no sport changed more dramatically than that of football. Explain to our listeners, first of all, the, in a sense, the depths to which football, organized football at the collegiate level, had descended at this point in time. What a dangerous game it had become, and how President Roosevelt ended up being drawn into escalating concerns about whether or not this game should even be allowed to exist.
Football obviously is inherently dangerous, right? It remains dangerous to this day. And anytime you put a group of players on a field together and they have these massive collisions, people are going to get hurt. And so that's not new. You know, football as it evolved from, you know, rugby and soccer had always caused injuries. But by the time you get to the first decade of the 20th century, the death toll and the injury toll has increased to levels where people are not willing to put up with it anymore. So particularly in 1905, football has what journalists call a death harvest. And depending on the numbers you look at, somewhere between 18, 19, 20 players died on the college gridiron in the 1905 season alone. And that gets everyone's attention. The idea that this builds character and teamwork is all fine and good, but when you're talking about dozens of people dying and hundreds of, you know, serious injuries, broken bones, and worse, there's an abolition movement that pops up with a lot of influential people behind it. The idea being college football simply needs to be eradicated from at least the school system. You know, fine, play it on your own, but we're not going to make it part of education, right? And the leader of that abolition movement, or one of the leaders, is Charles Eliot, the president of Harvard, where Roosevelt went. So with all of this kind of swirling around, and I think as importantly as anything for Roosevelt, his son is playing football at Harvard during this time. Yeah, Roosevelt gets involved, and he has a belief in the value of rough, kind of manly sports, as he'll call them. But he's conflicted, too, especially when it comes to his own son. You know, it's all fine and well to say, I believe in football, but when it comes down to Ted Jr. getting out there, he's concerned that he might suffer a really terrible injury. So out of that concern, and because of all the controversy swirling around football, Roosevelt does get involved in the fall of 1905. In November of that year, he calls a meeting. He calls for the coaches and administrators, basically, of the team Princeton, Harvard, and Yale. And just to give it some context, don't think of, you know, Princeton, Harvard, and Yale football today. It's basically the equivalent of inviting who would it be? Probably Alabama, Ohio State, and USC football coaches today. You know, these are the big football programs of the time. And so Roosevelt invites them to the White House, and he has a sit-down. You know, and kind of imagine the scene here. You've got football coaches sitting in the White House with the President of the United States and the Secretary of State. And Roosevelt wants answers. And so they sit down and have a long discussion about football. And in that actual meeting itself, not a whole lot gets done. I think one of the ways we distort the history a little bit of this is occasionally it's been said that Roosevelt somehow saves football. I think that's a pretty significant overreach. But what he does is he shows support for the game, interest in the game, and he gets people in the same room. And from that point, a series of meetings happen. You know, and this kind of is fitting, right? This is an American history, and there's violence and meetings involved, right? As you know, it's been said about football. And so a series of meetings happen, and by the time you get to 1906, the organization that will eventually be named the NCAA is formed, and it is primarily concerned with regulating football. And it's a really tough balance. The NCAA wants to keep football violent and dangerous to a certain extent, but it wants to kind of, you know, round off the rough edges that make it so violent that it can't remain popular anymore. So, yeah, this is a really crucial time in football's development.
Can you briefly explain why, when we read the accounts of those raising serious concerns about football, they keep using the word dishonest? Somebody named Endicott Peabody, for instance, mm-hmm. writes to President Roosevelt and talks about how this fundamental dishonesty calls for immediate treatment. What about the brutal violence of football in this era? What about it was dishonest? Why does that term keep coming up?
Yeah, it's a strange way to talk about it, isn't it? Endicott Peabody is the superintendent of a primary of a prominent boarding school on the East Coast, where actually Roosevelt's children go. And so when Peabody looks at football, he thinks that if everything worked out the way it was supposed to, if everybody played by the rules, and if the strategy, you know, that was used didn't involve deception, then football would work in a way that was, yes, rough and challenging, but it wouldn't go over the line. And so Peabody and others espouse this idea that it's not that there's something wrong with football. It's in the way that it's being implemented and that there's kind of this dishonesty. So, you know, what he's kind of referring to in some ways is coaches finding loopholes in the rules that allow for particularly violent plays to happen. And I think it's kind of a naive way to talk about the game. I think I would expect that coaches are going to use whatever tactics they can to win. But he expected, and this is somewhat typical of the time, he expected that coaches would know better. You know, well, I could get an easy touchdown doing this, but I'm not going to because it's against the spirit of the game. And just as one, I don't know, other way to understand this, some of the people talking about dishonesty in football would say the same about baseball, and they would talk about things like curveballs, which, you know, that's inherently dishonest to curve the ball on the way to the plate. And so, you know, that kind of, it breaks the moral standards of sports. And so that's what that term is getting at. But it seems pretty dated when we look at it now.
Absolutely. A couple other quick things to touch on. One of them is that for the first time, the United States hosts an Olympic Games. That's in the summer of 1904 in St. Louis, Missouri. And the modern games were, of course, brand new, having just been resurrected in 1896 in Athens. There was a game in Paris that you describe as being pretty disastrous in its disorganization. And so the 1904 Olympics, which ultimately came to St. Louis, were a really make-or-break event for the modern Olympics movement. And fortunately, at least in some respects, it went very well, and certainly went super, super well for America in terms of, yeah, of winning medals. I thought I'm so glad you included in your book a really interesting exchange between the organizer of the modern Olympic Games and President Roosevelt in terms of trying to get him on board to, in a sense, endorse Olympics in America and come aboard as honorary president, something that President Roosevelt was, to us at least, surprisingly reluctant and unwilling to do. And their exchange of letters is absolutely fascinating. Just say a quick word about this interesting moment in Roosevelt's presidency.
The Olympics are just, yeah, as you said, the modern Olympics are in their infancy. And so Pierre Coubertin a Frenchman is really trying to get them to become important internationally. And so with Roosevelt in the White House, and by the time you get to 1901, 1902, the idea of him as this strenuous president is well established. Coubertin starts reaching out to Roosevelt and asking him to support the Olympics in the United States. And I was surprised as well when Roosevelt doesn't immediately jump on the idea. You know, he's very supportive of most sports organizations. I speculate that perhaps it has to do with Roosevelt's strong linkage of kind of national pride and athletics that he's hesitant. But what Coubertin does that's pretty brilliant is when Roosevelt doesn't support him on the first couple of tries, you know, I don't know about you, but if the president was kind of blowing me off, I wouldn't respond with a much longer, more detailed letter. But that's what Coubertin does, and basically he gets to Roosevelt's curiosity, and he gets Roosevelt to engage in a series of letters and exchanges about what sports are supposed to do, and he gets Roosevelt to write about his own children and how athletic are they. And in engaging Roosevelt's kind of curiosity, he does win Roosevelt over, so he serves as honorary president. And in terms of the games themselves, just briefly, in 1904, they're more successful than the ones in Paris, but what's interesting is the United States basically combines the Olympic Games with a celebration of the Louisiana Purchase, which strangely had been delayed for a year. So it's a very kind of nationally focused Olympic Games, but it's well attended, and it does solidify the Olympic movement to a certain extent.
Your book goes on to explain in really interesting detail the creation of the New York City Public Schools Athletic League, or PSAL, which really draws athletic endeavor and physical development into the public school day in a number of different respects. And I appreciate the detail with which you explore this. I appreciate that your book includes mention of developments in other sports, including baseball and boxing, where Jack Johnson, at the end of this decade, becomes the first African-American to be American heavyweight boxing champion. I actually want to flip back to President Roosevelt in our last couple of minutes to have you talk about where your book begins. And it begins right outside the White House in something that Roosevelt had constructed. And I think it says so much about the centrality of athletic endeavor in President Roosevelt's life. Explain to our listeners where your book begins.
So my book begins with the tennis court that was built at the White House almost immediately after Roosevelt becomes president. So Roosevelt, as part of his story, is certainly the fact that he has six children makes him a different presidential family, right? So when he moves into the White House, a massive restoration remodel takes place. And as part of that effort, a tennis court is installed. And don't think kind of out far away from the, there's a tennis court still on the White House grounds today, which Obama used, you know, to shoot baskets. There's a basketball hoop on it now. But Roosevelt's tennis court actually sits right where the Oval Office is today. And so Roosevelt's office, executive office, was there, and just mere 4 or 5 feet he had to walk outside of his door to get to the tennis court. And this tennis court becomes absolutely, as you say, a real touchstone of athletics. Roosevelt plays all the time. He invites all sorts of people to play with him. And so I begin the book with a story of a bureaucrat, Lawrence Murray, who's just recently back in the government, who's invited to play tennis at the White House. And I think like we would all feel, he's nervous, right? You know, if you're invited to play with the president, he's worried about being on the president's team when they play doubles. And, you know, he does okay, but then as I detail kind of to get the book rolling, what starts on this important tennis court, rain comes through, as often happens in Washington, D.C. in the summer. And instead of finishing the tennis match, the four gentlemen assembled, or the three and Roosevelt, head off on this muddy romp through Rock Creek Park, where Lawrence Murray, who thought he was going to be playing tennis that day, ends up losing his shoes and being left behind in kind of the wilds of Washington, D.C. So that's the tennis court. It is very important during Roosevelt's administration, both in terms of what happens on it and with kind of some cultural significance as well.
Right. It says a lot about who he was and what was important to him. We learn so much about him and more about our nation at the brink of the 20th century in your fascinating book, The Strenuous Life, Theodore Roosevelt and the Making of the American Athlete, published by Diversion Books, the author, Ryan Swanson. Professor Swanson, thank you so much for writing such a great book and for talking about it today on The Morning Show. I really enjoyed this.